This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our radio is a Main Street communication device this time of day. Our microphones send the signal all across the state of North Dakota. And we've got those real ones where we greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds and maybe occasionally wonder what happened to somebody who used to be on that street. Maybe they've, cut their mortal coil to this earth or moved to another place because they're in an advanced age. And many of us are getting there, as a matter of fact. So we're going to talk about old age with an expert, Amy Miller. She's the director of memory care at Touchmark Senior Living in Bismarck. She joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to specifically be talking about memory care, not just nursing home care. But let's get with a basic definition here of memory care. What is it and how is it administered?
Sure. Memory care is a place where people with dementia, what a lot of people call Alzheimer's, it's a place that they can come that we have specialized care for them that keeps them safe, engages their daily living, and gives them the quality of life the best that we can throughout the disease or as the disease progresses.
What percentage of nursing home patients need memory care?
So 1 in 10 people over the age of 65 are actually diagnosed with dementia. And dementia is a term that talks about basically cells in your brain dying. And if you look at dementia as an umbrella and a whole bunch of raindrops underneath, we often hear the term Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's is just one of those raindrops. There's actually over 80 types of different types of dementia underneath that umbrella of dementia.
So when you say roughly 10% of those diagnosed have dementia, that not everybody's diagnosed.
No, definitely not. And I think we're getting better in today's day and age of diagnosing people. If we go back even into the 1970s, people were not being diagnosed with dementia. They were being sent to mental institutions, or it was just always crazy grandma or crazy grandpa. And they were written off, and families weren't able to take care of them, didn't have the means to do so, or didn't have the knowledge to do so. And there's been so much education and research done that we've come a long ways in that. Unfortunately, we're quite a ways, though, from finding a cure for dementia.
But is diagnosis itself difficult?
Diagnosis is – it can be tricky because a lot of people start to show signs and symptoms before anybody else notices. And if you're showing signs or symptoms or all of a sudden you're forgetting things here and there and it's bothering you, but you can cover those things. And as the disease progresses, you might have it for 10 or 15 years before it gets to a point that your family is recognizing those types of things and that they're saying, boy, we really need to check to see if mom or dad or grandma and grandpa have some memory loss. Once we get in with a physician and do the proper testing, then it is easily diagnosed, mostly easily diagnosed. It can be tricky sometimes, but we've come a long ways where in today's day and age it can be diagnosed as long as the person is, realizes that early on that they can be helped.
Are there symptoms besides memory loss?
Memory loss is the one that we always put towards that. It could be finding your words, word soup, replacing a word with a different word. You can't find the right word. There's lots of different things. It's hiding things and maybe a little bit of paranoia or depression of putting your purse somewhere in a safe place and then forgetting where you put it because you think somebody's going to get it. So there are several little things to look for before somebody is diagnosed if you think that they're having some issues.
Do the symptoms of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia vary?
They do. And it really depends on some. There's a vascular dementia that starts actually when people have a stroke. And so those signs and symptoms are different than somebody who has, say, early onset dementia, which they get when they're younger, and or Huntington's disease, which is kind of mirrors a Parkinson's route at times with their movements and so forth. And so every dementia has a little bit of a different twist to it. And everybody's journey with dementia is different. So you and I could have the same exact type of dementia and we wouldn't have the same symptoms. We wouldn't have that same journey through it.
Amy Miller is the Director of Memory Care for Touchmark Senior Living in Bismarck. Amy, when a new resident comes into your memory care unit, what's the evaluation process?
So we at Touchmark are a basic care community. And so when we do not do skilled care, so we can only have residents stay with us. They have to be somewhat able to care a little bit for themselves or with the assistance of one person. There is a difference between the nursing home and the basic care. So we do have a criteria that they have to meet in order to come in to our memory care. And most everybody with dementia and Alzheimer's meets that criteria because the brain usually goes before the body does. The physical part of the body seems to stay strong as the brain is actually decreasing and going downhill. The part of once they meet that criteria to come into Touchmark, our goal is to keep them engaged. And we have many programs that help us do that on a daily basis to help them keep them engaged, helping them in the moment because maybe they don't remember what's happened a year ago or even 10 years ago, but what happens right now in the moment is what's important to them.
So Touchmark is sort of that place in between living at home and living in a skilled nursing facility?
Yes, but our goal is once we bring people or once people choose to make Touchmark their home, is that we keep them there until end of life if we're able to do so. And by keeping them engaged in daily activities that we have at Touchmark, like a functional fitness program, which is our exercise program that we do 7 days a week. Exercise is so good for the brain, whether we have dementia or not. But people with dementia, we see an increase in just their clarity for the day. If we can start with that exercise and get them moving and interacting with them. And so that helps. So we have programs like that. We use the best friends approach. So our care that we do with the residents is based on their past history. So that if we know that our friend Hilda likes her tea with one lump of sugar and a little bit of honey, instead of asking her and having her maybe get her frustrations through that, we're going to greet her in the morning where here's your favorite type of tea with one scoop of sugar and a little bit of honey in there.
What kind of training is there for somebody who is a memory care specialist?
So we have a couple of programs that we offer, and one is I'm a Best Friends Certified Master Trainer. So we train all of our caregivers to basically take care of our residents the way you would your best friend. Instead of saying, okay, here's your red shirt and your blue pants you're going to wear, it's taking two shirts out of the closet and saying, gosh, it's a nice sunny day outside today. You know, the birds are singing. And would you like to wear your red shirt today or your blue shirt? And so we teach our resident or our staff to work with our residents on everything that they do, including working with their behaviors on how you would a best friend. So if somebody's looking, one of the things with dementia is a lot of times people want to go home or they get agitated or they're not all of a sudden comfortable in their surroundings. Well, a best friend wouldn't walk away and say, well, you live here now. That's what we need to deal with. Instead, a best friend would say, hey, why don't you come with me and let's go look at some, can you show me who are in these pictures or tell me about your grandkids or, tell me about your parents. It depends on where they're at in that dementia process. We have a friend at Touchmark who drew bridges for a living. He loves to draw. He loves to talk. And he can have some bad days. And so what we say is, come along with us. And we have a nice big smart board. And we pull it up and we let him draw. And he will sit there and draw for us. And we'll stay engaged with him to allow him to do something and bring it back. And he's pretty darn good, probably a little slower than he was when he was younger. But it's kind of fun to know that about him instead of saying, well, let's go play cards, because that's not what this gentleman did. He drew bridges. He loves to draw. He loves to do that to give him a purpose.
Well, one of the reasons we were drawn to talking with you today is that there's a new program at Touchmark Senior Living in Bismarck, Fragrance and Frames, that uses a combination of art therapy and essential oils to help participants with memory issues. It's produced observable improvements, you say.
Yes. This has been one of my favorite things in my 8 years with Touchmark, and it took a good team of us to come up with this program, and we call it Fragrance and Frames. And we are, we're no stranger to using essential oils in our memory care neighborhood. We would use essential oils. We actually diffuse them, and we, this time of the year, we use a Thieves, which actually is supposed to ward off sicknesses, and it smells good beyond that. We use a peppermint at lunchtime by putting them on warm washcloths and having the residents wash their hands, and it will stimulate appetite. So what we did is we said, boy, we're having a good luck with these oils. And we also had a love, a couple of us on staff had a love for art, and we wanted to do something. So our vice president of clinical services, Wendy Schrog, from our central office, and also one of our life enrichment coordinators, Whitney Rushinsky, and I put our heads together and brought the oils and paintings. And sat, Whitney actually took this with a resident and sat down and said, gave them a lemon smelling essential oil and said, what does this remind you of? And the response was, oh, it smells like sunshine. It smells like lemons. And then they would ask, well, and then she would ask, well, what colors does that remind you of? And of course, she would pick yellow and she would pick orange and she picked all these wonderful colors. And Whitney put them out on paper for her and they're still smelling the oils. And pretty soon, Whitney has a paintbrush in her hand and they're painting these beautiful pictures. And what the oils did was bring some. Was working on their smelling. Well, their creativity in the moment was helping them put that brush to the paper. And one thing important about fragrance and frames is it wasn't necessarily about the outcome. That's not what we were looking for. It was keeping them engaged. How was this going to help them in their clarity for the rest of the day? But we found that it made some these residents that weren't artists before came out with some beautiful pictures with beautiful colors and something that surprised not only us or them, but their families, too, and people that have seen the pictures.
What results have you witnessed in terms of their behaviors?
Yep. So we have a an assessment that we do with them before that before they start the program. And this is every time that they do it. And we look at what their daily behaviors are. And so we work with the nurses and the care staff on that. So are they having a really agitated morning? Are they looking to go home or looking for an exit? Are they yelling, whatever it happens to be? What is their outward behavior? What's their body language look like? Because a lot of times people with dementia can't tell you that. So we need to be that best friend in that approach that we use at Touchmark and say, okay, so are they agitated? How's that looking? So we look at their outside or outward behavior. What is their verbal ability? Are they speaking in full sentences right now? Are they having problems finding their words? Are they mumbling? What is all happening? And then we have them sign a piece of paper. If they can still write their name, they don't have to do this, but we found it was a good measurement for us, is that we had them sign their paper before they started the art project. Once she went through the Fragrance and Frames program, we went ahead and documented what the behaviors were after for the rest of that day. And we were finding that their behaviors had improved. Sometimes it was just for a short amount of time, maybe just an hour, 2 hours. A lot of times it was for the full day. And the more and longer engagement that you can get to with somebody with dementia, that's worth it right there, even if it was only 5 minutes worth, but we were finding longer periods of time with that. The one that we were most, that took us off guard was the signature. I talked about the gentleman who built bridges for a living, and he had an art background, so his pictures were beyond amazing. But he went from signing his name, and it was legible, it was all right, to when he signed it afterwards, he had his beautiful signature, plus he added his credentials afterwards. So he went from this one gentleman who was, here I am living in a retirement community and I'm going to paint, to by the time he was done, here he was, John Smith, I'm the bridge builder. I'm back to where I was when I was in the highlight of my career.
Are there other types of sensory programs done in other places that are similar to this? Is this unique to Touchmark, or is this something that's catching on?
So this is actually unique to Touchmark that I'm aware of. We had submitted an app, actually were the recipients of an award from the International Council of Active Aging, which we were in Orlando in November and received an award for that. We were one of six programs internationally that were picked and won that award. So I feel that we are going to see it catch on in other care communities or long-term care communities throughout the United States and Canada.
Are you writing about this? Are you sharing this?
We are sharing it. It is out there. We have 12, soon to be 13 Touchmark communities across the United States and one in Canada. And all of those communities are starting that in their memory care neighborhoods. And over that, it's not a Touchmark traded program right now, but we are more than willing to share. And that's what we did out with the International Council of Active Aging in Orlando. And we're also featured in their magazine, so that we hope that it does catch on and we're willing to share these ideas with other communities too.
Can you give us a sense of how much this costs? North Dakota has some of the most expensive nursing home care in the country, but this is not that. This is senior living. If you're a senior living at Touchmark in Bismarck and you're getting memory care, what's the tab?
So great question. So basic care is going to be less expensive than nursing home care. And it really depends on what type of needs that the resident has coming in. But the last time I had checked, and so my numbers might be off here a little bit, but the skilled care, which is not what Touchmark does, was about $10,000 to $12,000. And for our basic care, we're probably looking at about around that $5,000 mark for basic care to start with.
Do we have enough trained people to be in places like where you're working?
You know, I think staffing in North Dakota and the surrounding states right now is always an issue. Luckily, we have an environment at Touchmark that we have been able to bring in some really good caregivers and be able to retain them along with our nurses and other team members. We often hear from our team members as they come in and they say, wow, this is really nice. I've never been in a place like this and everybody's so friendly. So we take pride in the people that work for us really do take pride in they know that they have to earn the opportunity to return and serve to work the next day. So we're lucky in that respect.
Well, one thing that's inevitable at a place like yours is that there is that transition that occurs. Does that disrupt the rest of the group when somebody isn't there anymore?
You know, it always does. We lose friends along the way. And whether it's if somebody has to move on to a different community or a skilled community, or whether they pass away, tears are had by all. You make great friends along the way, and it is hard to lose them. And like I said, our goal is, and that's where memory care has come in a lot throughout the years. And with our program at Touchmark, and even in our independent and assisted living at Touchmark, we really take pride in our program, which encompasses six dimensions of wellness, which includes occupational wellness, social wellness, emotional wellness, intellectual, spiritual, and environmental wellness. And all of these things combined really have the opportunity to extend a person's life and give them the best quality of life for as long as we can.
Amy Miller is the Director of Memory Care for Touchmark Senior Living in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media with a report on conservation and the Farm Bill.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra proudly presents an evening of food, fun, and cocktails with Dixieland Jazz on February 16th at 1603 Main Event Center in Bismarck. Experience a unique live performance that takes you back to the start of the 20th century, featuring traditional jazz from the Deep South, thanks to the Doc Linlow Memorial Dixieland Band, under the direction of Dennis Gowan. Ticketing information is available online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A fraction of the money in the Farm Bill that Congress will take up later this year is aimed at protecting natural resources like soil and water. As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, changes to those conservation programs impact the environment and farmers' bottom lines.
The slew of federal conservation programs gives farmers another financial reason to keep land, water, air, and animals healthy. But most importantly, says Larry Clemens of the environmental group The Nature Conservancy, the Farm Bill protects private land and mitigates issues like nutrient runoff that's harmful to drinking water and aquatic life.
It provides ranchers, farmers, and forest landowners with the tools necessary to protect and conserve not only the land, but also their way of life.
There are three main and popular programs, to the point that some farmers have been waiting for years to join. But there's also a debate about whether the programs pay farmers for doing nothing with the land. We'll get back to that. First, let's break down the biggest programs that get the lion's share of conservation funding. The first two are pretty similar. One is called the Conservation Stewardship Program and covers up to 10 million acres, about the size of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. The second is called EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. Both pay farmers to use methods like planting cover crops. Ryan Britt, a fifth-generation farmer in Clifton, Missouri, received EQIP money to install a more environmentally friendly grazing system for his cattle. He says doing so improves his soil health and helps his bottom line.
Not only is it important to me as an average producer that I am profitable, and to be profitable, I have to make sure that I'm efficient, that I'm not wasting anything.
Britt says he'd like more money so he can terrace his land to prevent erosion, but is running up against the program's popularity. In 2016, EQIP was paying for more than 36,000 different projects.
I've had an application for cost share terraces federally for 3 years that has not been granted yet.
What's the holdup?
Just competitiveness.
Britt also owns a plot of land in the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP. That's our third program and the largest one. The federal government pays farmers like Britt to take highly erodible land out of production, effectively retiring that land, usually for 10 to 15 years. But Britt says he's concerned that CRP land is being taken advantage of.
Certain counties within Missouri has a high enough cash rent rate that it's actually competing with young producers trying to expand or trying to be able to provide for their family.
Basically, he's saying some farmers can make more money enrolling their land in the CRP program rather than leasing it to others. CRP land is capped at 24 million acres, the size of Indiana, and it's nearly full.
In fact, the situation now where we're very close to the cap is actually somewhat unusual in the history of the program.
Pat Westhoff is the director of the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri. He says while some farmers would like to see land taken out of CRP and returned to production, others think adding acres would help those who have been dealing with a glut of grain and low crop prices.
Frankly, it's a supply control measure. If there's less land being used for crop production, that will give at least a modest bump to commodity prices and therefore protect the income of other farmers.
Farmers have been asking lawmakers to, if nothing else, keep conservation program funding as it stands. But beyond the financial aspect, conservation practices impact the health of the U.S. ecosystem. Take the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Chemicals and waste from farms in the Midwest flowed south, turning a big part of the Gulf into a place nothing will grow. Environmentalists and many farmers hope more conservation practices upstream can better protect all living things downstream. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear from Bob Boylan, the host of NPR's All Songs Considered, and he'll talk about his Tiny Desk Contest. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Public Service Commission has agreed to delay the formal hearings into MDU's request for a natural gas rate increase. The original hearing was scheduled to start on February 28th. It is now scheduled to begin May 30th. MDU has asked for a 5.4% rate increase, and that would bump up the average customer's monthly gas bill by just under $3 a month. The utility asked for the delay as it figures out how the new federal tax cuts factor into that rate. Here's Public Service Commissioner Brian Crotchus.
I would like to see a considerable portion of this go back to customers and see that reflected in the rate structure. There will be other potential considerations, and it's a case that companies will have to make in terms of where else would the money go. Will it go to future infrastructure projects as well to strengthen the pipeline and transmission network that they have in place? But that's a case that they'll have to make.
Meanwhile, the PSC asked the investor-owned utilities, MDU, Xcel, Otter Tail, and Great Plains Natural Gas, how the tax cut will help consumers. The PSC set a February 15th deadline for that information. None of the utilities has submitted their reports as of this afternoon. Income tax season is underway, and North Dakota Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says if you are to receive a tax refund, you'll notice it will be coming back a little slower than it used to. The reason?
Because we're so focused on fraud detection. We've detected, you know, over $2 million in fraudulent refunds over the last couple of years, 1,400 fraud cases. So we're taking it very seriously. So we ask taxpayers to be patient.
Rauschenberger says if you want to find out the status of your refund, you can go to the tax department's website, nd.gov/tax.
And click, where's my refund? And you can basically put in a couple pieces of your private information, and you'll be able to see where your refund's at in the process.
Rauschenberger says taxpayers can be assured the department has precautions in place to stop potential fraud. And Minnesota state legislators are on different pages about borrowing for public works construction projects this year. Governor Dayton has proposed a $1.5 billion bonding bill. The Senate's leading Democrat says she would settle for a $1 billion package. Republicans have put the target at $800 million or less. DFL House Minority Leader Melissa Hortman says it's not a time to skimp.
Just as a family, when they're looking at when to take out a mortgage, looks at what's happening with the interest rates, this is the time for the state to maximize its borrowing and get those projects underway, because they are going to be more expensive in the future for two reasons. We know inflation's coming, and we know interest rates are going up.
There is consensus among legislative leaders that some money should be spent on existing government buildings. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thanks for listening to Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Attention, musicians. You have the chance to play at the famous Tiny Desk at NPR. That's right, for the fourth year, the Tiny Desk contest is underway. The first year's winner, Fantastic Negrito, by the way, has already won a Grammy. The 2016 winner, Minnesota's Galen Lee, played the Kennedy Center. Last year's winner, Tank and the Bangas, played at Coachella. A couple of years ago, NPR's Bob Boylan, who owns the Tiny Desk, joined us to talk about the contest he created for his show, All Songs Considered. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
What is All Songs Considered?
Well, it's a music show, and we try to find every week about six or eight songs that hopefully the listener will fall in love with. So we certainly try to fall in love with lots of music every week and like to pass on that passion.
Well, our director of radio, Bill Thomas, is a big fan, and he tells me that All Songs Considered had an interesting beginning, having to do with the bumper music that National Public Radio used.
Absolutely. So I directed All Things Considered for 18 years, and in that 18 years, I picked music in between news stories. It's something, you know, that NPR does kind of pretty good, you know, and nobody else sort of has that sort of signature. And I had lots of fun doing it, but I would get letters all the time from people saying, what was that music? I mean, just all the time, just before the internet. And then when we started the internet, we started to post things online and people would send me emails, what was that music? And or they'd find it and get turned on to something brand new just from, you know, 20 seconds of this or 60 seconds of that. So the idea was that I'd start a show that would feature music that was played in between the news stories, and started doing that for a little bit, but quickly realized that there's so much good music that just making it instrumental music, just, you know, having that little restriction just seemed silly in the face of all the great music I was getting at the time. So our music show is now any kind of music from anywhere that we find passion for.
And that takes us to this contest, the Tiny Desk Contest. Explain it to our listeners.
Sure. So let's start with what a Tiny Desk concert is. It's an intimate concert literally at my desk at NPR. We invite artists that are famous, So Adele or Tom Jones or Wilco or John Legend would come to my desk and play a concert with instrumentation of their choosing. The stipulation is that we do not amplify the voice in the room, so that if you imagine an artist playing in your living room, their instrumentation around them wouldn't be louder than that. It doesn't mean they can't be really amped up, but the singer would have to sing fairly loud and passionately. So we've been doing that since 2008. And we had this idea that there's talent all over the country. We wanted to hear some of the things that we would never, ever discover on our own.
Well, I went online, went up to YouTube, typed in Tiny Desk, and my heavens, it just rained this fantastic music. And that takes us back to that first question. Why the desk? Doesn't that create some real challenges for those musicians?
And that's exactly the reason. Artists rise to the occasion. Artists like restrictions. I'll tell you they don't, but the truth is the better the artists, the more they figure out how to do something interesting in a situation that is unusual. And so what we wind up with are these intimate sets from artists, and they walk away having done something that they wouldn't have done otherwise. Look, I produced music stories for All Things Considered with artists for the 19 years I was at All Things Considered. And we'd bring them in a studio and oftentimes basically recreate the sound of the record they'd recorded already. And I started scratching my head saying, well, we should try to figure out a way to challenge the artists more. And this was one of those ways.
We have many, many, many musicians around here. And that's not unusual. This country is flooded with musicians. So tell our listeners how they can become a contestant in the Tiny Desk contest.
The specific rules are on the page, but the essence of it is this. If you are a talented musician and proud of what you do, get somebody to make a video of the best thing you know how to do. Gather your friends, find a videographer or someone with a phone with a camera, and send it to us. We care most about the song. We're not looking for high production here. The only stipulation is that they shoot the video at a desk of their choosing. That's the thing they have to do.
You need that prop.
That's right. Exactly. So you could take that, as some people did, out into the woods. You can do it at your at the mayor's office in town. You can do it at the desk where you work. You use your imagination there. We like that.
Well, is there criteria? Or is there anything in particular they're looking for, or just something that blows them away?
Well, I think the blows them away is really a positive that we all look for. We look for someone who is doing something in a way that no one else can. So there are many great guitar players, but we're looking for that guitar player perhaps that plays like no one you've ever heard before, or that singer that sings like no one else, or the lyrics are unusual, just something that isn't every day. Something that really stands out.
And what's in it for the winner?
The winner gets to play behind my desk, which means that lots of people will then know of them. And then we'll take them on a tour. We'll go to 10 different cities around the country, member stations and other popular places, and they'll get out into the world. I think it's a good time and also a way to get exposed. And for many of these people, maybe it'd be the first time out on the road. You know, we're not looking for anyone who has a record contract. In fact, the rules require that you not have one. We're looking for fresh, new talent.
Well, when I went up on that YouTube site again, I came across another Tiny Desk concert featuring Polyphonic Spree. And so obviously you're not limiting yourself to one or two performers either, because I counted at least 14 that group, and they were also dynamite.
Yeah, so we've had up to 23 people behind that desk, although it is small, but we squeeze them in there. It could be a soloist with a guitar, or it could be a harpist. It could be or a big, big, big band.
Well, I've seen your desk and I've heard applause. So is this like a performance space at NPR?
It's a chance for people in the building at NPR, workers and worker friends, to be invited to come and watch. So sometimes we'll have 30, 40 people watching. Sometimes we'll have, in the case of someone like John Legend or someone, we might have 300 people squeezed in to the office there. But it is my office. It is my desk. It's not a performance space.
Now, as this contest is running, will we be able to, you know, find out if somebody from our part of the country is in the running?
So we have a couple of things going on. One of them is a Tumblr page that we feature interesting videos as they come in. So it's tinydeskcontest.tumblr.com. And also, if you just search Tiny Desk Contest and NPR, you'll find what you need. And so a lot of the unique, talented people we see as it's coming in, we'll put up and post there. And that gives the people who may not win a chance to be seen and heard. So it's not just about the winner.
Well, my colleague Ashley Thornburg wants me to ask if Ari Shapiro, who sings with a group called Pink Martini, have they played the desk?
He hasn't, but he's chomping at the bit.
Okay. Has there ever been any thought about releasing some sort of compilation of the Tiny Desk's greatest hits?
I like the idea. I'll think about it.
Okay. Bob Boylan is the host of All Songs Considered with Robin Hilton, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care now.
That conversation took place in January 2016. The website again is tinydeskcontest.npr.org. Coming up, how to fall in love with anyone.
To innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking. Gilligan's Island. Apparently, it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
Discover what Venice was really like in the 18th century age of Casanova.
The convents in Venice, many of them were actually harems.
Get to know the Caribbean.
By and large, the culture of the islands was formed by Europe's appetite, in particular for sugar.
And take a fresh look at Florida.
Alligators are my heroes. I know of at least three instances where alligators helped the police capture crooks who were trying to get away.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A few years back, the New York Times got lots of attention for an article titled 36 Questions That Lead to Love. It was from a 1997 study by social scientist Arthur Aaron from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. The idea was that scientists could induce feelings of intimacy between two people simply by asking them to answer a list of 36 questions. Today we'll share a conversation about those questions with Tanzina Vega, segment host for Public Radio's The Takeaway, and Dacher Keltner. Keltner is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the director of Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center and the host of the new podcast, The Science of Happiness, which is co-produced by the Greater Good Science Center and PRI.
So they start off the 36 questions kind of innocuously. You know, who do you like to have at a dinner party? Do you ever sing to yourself? What is your favorite color? And then they move progressively to kind of deeper, more philosophical questions, even things like, you know, have you thought about how you're going to die? Or who would you most mourn if someone in your family passed away? What's wonderful about these questions is they capture all the dynamics by which we form friendships and become close to one another.
And I know a lot of people that did this 36 questions, including me, and social scientists have continued to use the 36 questions, and they're not just using it to spark romance. Turns out that this exercise can tell us something about what makes us happy and may even improve cross-cultural understanding. Using the research of UC Berkeley researcher Rudy Mendoza-Denton, Dacher explains how 36 questions can get to the heart of how humans are wired to crave intimacy.
When you survey this broad landscape of new science, the striking generalization is relationships are the biggest determinant of human happiness. There's one analysis of over 100 studies showing that strong relationships not only make you happy, they give you about 10 years of life expectancy. And so what that tells us is it's really the dynamics between people that are the most important sources of our individual happiness. And one of them is intimacy, like you say, just feeling close and trusting. And also within the 36 questions exercise, what happens is that people's sense of themselves, which is often bounded and separate from other individuals, starts to expand. And you feel this sense of interconnectedness with the people you go through the exercise. So intimacy, trust, expanded self really matter in terms of our own individual happiness.
Now, obviously, we're living in an era where we're all sort of staring at our phones, and it seems like in many ways we are disconnected, and it's been shown that social media in particular can heighten feelings of loneliness and disconnectedness. What's your take on the impact that technology has had on our happiness and our ability to connect?
That is the question of today, Tanzina, is, you know, we have these radical new ways of relating to each other. And, you know, frankly, the United States has a loneliness problem. 30% of Americans feel lonely and isolated, not solitude, which is a wonderful state where you're walking in the woods by yourself and contemplating things or whatever it may be, but loneliness and isolation. And there are a lot of neurophysiological problems associated with that state. And that's why I like this 36 questions exercise, as hokey as it sounds, right? It gets us back to these basic social tendencies of asking somebody some questions, discovering something about somebody, laughing. So I see the science of happiness as a corrective or a way to combat the structural loneliness that's so pervasive today.
How should one approach the 36 questions? Is it something for couples who have been together for a while, or am I on a first date and I take out the scroll and begin at question one? Where do we sort of draw the line? And by the way, I did do the questions once in a relationship.
You did?
I did, yeah. And it,
how'd
and
it go?
Was, the relationship, not so good. The questions were phenomenal. There was a real shift in intimacy, and it was pretty immediate.
So I think that these questions are especially powerful when there are kind of barriers or pre-existing tendencies that get in the way of just wonderful intimacy. So, you know, in a long-term relationship, you get locked into these patterns of communicating, you know, how are the kids? Did you do the dishes? How's our checkbook? Good night, you know, and the questions return us to those late night conversations that are so wonderful. And then, you know, again, Rudy Mendoza-Denton's terrific insight that, you know, when we're talking to somebody who's of a different racial background or comes from a different neighborhood or a different religion, there are all these stereotypes and expectations that society imposes upon us. And the literature on cross-race contact and cross-class contact finds we tend to get anxious and sort of we trip over ourselves when we're interacting with people who are different from us. And the questions provide this wonderful game-like frame to get closer. So you can take two strangers who are Latino and European American, and with all the kind of concerns they might have when they enter into this exercise, just sharing this humanity through 36 questions, it brings them closer. And here's a really amazing finding, Tanzina, that Rudy's been interested in, which is one of the real divides is for people of different ethnic backgrounds to trust institutions. How would a person of color trust the police right now? How, in Rudy's interests, does a person from a lower class background or a person of color who's the first to go to college in their family trust an institution that has a long history of not including these kinds of people. And Rudy finds when Latino or an African-American does these questions with a European-American at different universities, they end up trusting those institutions more. The feeling for this new friend generalizes to these institutions that they're starting to integrate into. So I think this is a really interesting lesson about the broader challenge you're issuing.
And I wonder if it's also, humanizing people. It sounds like that's really what we're talking about here, is getting past this, these sort of disconnected Twitter handles and Facebook profiles to really sort of connect on a human level, right, in ways that I think it's much more difficult to say the things that some people say on social media if the person is actually right in front of you.
Humanizing is right at the core of this exercise, and it's what people are hungering for today. You know, a lot of the data that I teach in the science of happiness speaks to almost the dehumanizing qualities of our contemporary life, which is out here in California, the average person is spending an hour by themselves in a car. They often spend a lot of time just interacting with strangers, right, as opposed to people they love. And we crave face-to-face contact. You know, I'm so happy to see the millennials reintroducing game night. You know, everywhere I go, my daughters and these younger people are playing games like people did 50 years ago.
Unbelievable. Actually together in the same room.
Exactly. Can you imagine?
I can. I'm going to go get my laughing old Trivial Pursuit out. Yes, this is exciting.
It is. And I think that's because we crave this. One of my favorite questions in the 36 questions is one of the ultimate humanizers, which is it asks you, like, tell something embarrassing about that you've recently done, right? And people love to share self-deprecating, embarrassing stories. And we know from the science that, if you share something embarrassing, I kind of feel sorry for you. I have the pangs of compassion, perhaps. I reach out and laugh with you. It's humanizing. So that's what we need.
Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and director of Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. His new podcast is called The Science of Happiness.
That segment of The Takeaway was hosted by Tenzina Vega, and that gives us the opportunity now to share some romantic messages from our members who participated in the Short and Sweet membership drive, which included sweet cocoa truffles. Ashley Thornburg and I have got some Valentine's Day messages that were included with those boxes of truffles, Ashley.
We got a couple great ones, like sharing love is mandatory, sharing truffles is optional, sending lots of love from North Dakota.
And here's one. Happy Valentine's Day. This year, you get your own box.
That's pretty generous. That's a good upgrade. All right, here's one. Hide these from the kids. Okay, maybe they can have one. Not the baby, though. She doesn't have teeth.
How about this one? Roses are red. Violets are blue. I love truffles almost as much as I love you.
Oh, nice. All right, here's one. To my dear friend, you overcame every obstacle and still remain yourself. Kind, radiant, consistent, and a true friend to me. Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. Well, here's one, sending you two lovebirds, warmth and love, from the frozen north. Looking forward to this summer.
All right, I got one more here. I can't pass it up. All I want is for you to be happy and naked.
Wow. Ooh. Dakota Datebook is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week, an American in Paris, Braden Perkins, chef owner of two Parisian restaurants, talks to Milk Street about how he beat the odds to become a successful Parisian restaurateur. J. Kenji Lopez-Alt explains what happens to alcohol when you cook with it, and we introduce Vietnamese meatball and watercress soup. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
I was desperately in love with a girl who was dead and with a man who was living but psychotic, and it was the happiest time of my life.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, sewing, singing, suits, and cemeteries. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 14th. North Dakota remembers World War I.
with the North Dakota boys manning the trenches on the front lines on this date in 1918, local newspapers were carefully scrutinized, hoping that the name of a loved one would not appear on the latest casualty list. On February 1st, the Associated Press carried a story on an unnamed soldier who had been wounded during a German raid on a little village in France. He told the correspondent that after being drafted, he had come to France with a division of former National Guardsmen. He had only been in France for a few weeks. The reporter described him as covered in mud from head to foot, a sandy-haired youth from a farm near Bismarck. After being hit in the leg with shrapnel and undergoing surgery, the soldier stated that there were only two things he really wanted. One was that he get another chance to fight the Boche and do the job he came there for. His second wish, he stated he would give 2 months' pay for a large beefsteak smothered in onions. When the story was circulated nationally by the Associated Press, the young man had mothers to spare. Every woman around Bismarck with a drafted son was absolutely sure this was her boy. One woman stated that her son was always crazy to get over there and take a shot at the Boche. Another woman based her claim on the beefsteak and onions and that there was not another boy in France who could eat as much as her boy. There was even one woman from Chicago who claimed that the young man was her sandy-haired brother, Henry Vogelman, who, when last heard from, was working on a farm near Bismarck. Unfortunately, the individual's identity was never confirmed, but most believed it was Corporal Joe Matthews. He had been wounded in the same battle that took the life of Louis Owsley, the first North Dakota Guardsman to die in France. Although Matthews survived the war, he was seriously wounded 3 times. He also had achieved the dubious honor of being one of North Dakota's most killed soldiers, having been reported as killed in action several times. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Sometimes it can be hard to let go, but it's time. Long may you ride. That vehicle you love can keep on revving when you donate it to the station you love, Prairie Public. We'll pick up your car, and your donation may be tax deductible. Just call 844-440-6900 or visit us online at prairiepublic.org/car.
I once had a car that was more like a home.
As tensions increase between the United States and China, the U.S. ambassador in Beijing is in a unique position.
I'm one of the very few people that has a great relationship with both President Xi Jinping and President Donald Trump.
So can those personal relationships ease the friction in the world's most important global relationship? On the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll learn about St. John the Divine Episcopal Church in Moorhead from parishioner Barbara Glassroot. Her church has an impressive architectural history and many new Americans as its members. Chef Rosie's topic will be something unusual in our part of the country, boiled peanuts. We might give them a try, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.